Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Greetings, hello, hi, welcome to the Slacker Podcast. My name is Phil Taggart. I am 6 foot, Northern Irish, Cub Scout quiz runner-up, 1996. What else can I tell you? I guess that's me. I've never really achieved anything since 1996, apart from maybe this podcast. And you're listening to it right now. The finest music podcast coming out of the UK and Ireland right now. If this is your first time listening to the Slacker Podcast, you're very, very welcome. Welcome into the comforting bosom of music chat on a podcast. As it is a podcast, expect deep ramble. Some non sequiturs, some deep digressions, and really what you get with the Slacker Podcast is a really quality weekly roster of great guests. As of recent, on the Slacker Podcast, we've had Haim, which was last week. We had Leanne LaHavas the week before, Jaden Smith the week before that, Bob Geldof the week before that, Sleaford Mods the week before that, KSI the week before that, Phineas, but the week before that, Johnny Barrell the week before, I can't go any faster, Phoebe Bridgers the week before that, Run the Jewels. So this week we will be getting to our guest Jarvis Cocker. But before we get to that, this feels like a week that we need to mention something in the world of music, because it's my favorite award ceremony, my favorite music prize, which is the Mercury Music Prize, because it's the only one that, I don't know, it's the only one that just really fully celebrates the full project, the 10 tracks, the 14 tracks, just the full album. And it feels like the most, artistically credible of all of the sort of award ceremonies and prizes and all of the rest of that pomp. I always get very massively invested in the Mercury Music Prize. And this year is no different. And I was kind of going through everything going, I wonder who's going to get what. And I was looking at the shortlist today. And like on there, you've got Anna Meredith, Charlie XCX, Dua Lipa, Georgia, Kano, Lanterns on the Lake, Laura Marling, Michael Kiwanuka, Moses Boyd, Porridge Radio, Sports Team, Stormzy. It's pretty quality. It's pretty quality. A lot of them I've played on the radio. A lot of them you would hear on like Sex Music, some just like all of them on there are brilliant. Like I think like there's Lanterns on the Lake I need to listen to, and the Moses Boyd. I've actually heard half the Moses Boyd album, and Sports Team I wouldn't be the biggest fan of. They're good at what they do. It's just not my bag, and that's fine. Who do I think is going to get the Mercury Music Prize? I'm going to put the house on Charlie XCX. I think like she is one of the most important pop writers and just pop phenoms in the UK. She, like, I don't know, like she I feel like she's always been massively underappreciated, because like I think she should be a lot bigger than she actually is. Like, don't get me wrong, she's like sort of queen of the underground, but I just think that she's massively, massively, massively talented as a songwriter and as somebody who challenges the conventions of pop in a really, really interesting way. So I think How I'm Feeling Now, which was a record, I think one of the only sort of records that was made in lockdown that kind of didn't feel like it was cheesy, because a lot of people are releasing stuff that's come out of lockdown now, and it's like, you know, that's their selling point, and it feels like a million years ago that they're talking about, oh, this is a lockdown record, and you're like, oh god, that's so depressing to remember lockdown as we go into the flipping second wave of it. We're 5 minutes away from the government doing a big talk here at 11 o'clock as I record this. So I'm going to go and listen to that. But I'm going to leave you right now with this week's podcast, which is with Jarvis, which I'm going to get to in a minute. Sorry, super, super annoying. But if you enjoyed the podcast, go and sign up to the Slacker community on Patreon. And there's all sorts of extra bonus party stuff on there, and if you make music, it's quite useful as well, because we're reviewing tracks on the Patreon. There's gonna be a Patreon podcast exclusive where we just do podcasts where you guys ask the questions and sort of come up with the ideas for the podcast. It's almost like a two-way conversation, really. So if you want to join the Patreon community for as little as $2 a month, which is absolutely flip-all. What's that, like £1.50 or something? It's patreon.com/slackerpodcast. And yeah, it's you guys that are keeping the lights on at Slacker HQ, and I appreciate you for it. I was a little bit nervous, I guess, for this week's podcast, because I've been a huge Pulp fan since I was a little nipper running about the house back in Oma in Northern Ireland, singing Disco 2000 and Common People. There used to be a weird chart that would come on ITV in the middle of the day, and it felt like some sort of unofficial chart, but I just remember that Pulp would always come on it, and I would always lose my shit every single time it would come on. So it's great to have Jarvis. He was as charming as you would imagine Jarvis to be, and here is the podcast with Jarvis on the Slacker Podcast in 3, 2, 1. Joining us on the Slacker Podcast, we have got Jarvis. Hello, how you doing?
I'm not too bad, thanks.
How is it typical summer rain where you are? Because it's absolutely pissing it down in Brighton as we record this.
I'd describe it more as a drizzle. Or even a mizzle, you know, like when it's so fine, it's like almost like a mist.
Yeah.
It's quite nice, actually.
I live up on top, like at the top of the hill. Brighton's a very hilly place. And it's like one of those like computer games that you play where the zombies come out and get you. Because like it's pretty misty pretty much half the year.
Right. Is that pleasant?
If you're into zombie apocalypses, then it's like, you know, it's prime retail.
Right.
How have you been getting on recently? How's things?
Well, I don't know if you've heard about it. There's been this lockdown thing going on. Everybody's been going on about it.
I know, it's all the rage.
Yeah, I mean, I've been lucky. I'm kind of in the countryside in between Sheffield and Manchester. I'm quite near to my family up here. I can't really complain, you know. I've got a garden. I can walk around it like a teddy bear, as they say. And I've had a, compared to a lot of people, I think I've had a very cushy lockdown.
Yeah, I think like anybody who's got a garden, I don't think anybody would have seen maybe a year ago how important a garden would have been when you're sitting in the house. Or like, especially if you're like in flats or whatever, like it must be very tough.
Yeah, I mean, I've even got into gardening slightly. I've got a vegetable patch now.
What are you growing?
Oh, what am I not growing? I've got potatoes, sprouts, broccoli, leeks. I'm going across it from right to left here. Carrots, beetroot, courgettes, and tomatoes.
That's great. Do you know what? All around the Cocker household for the apocalypse when we can't get food anymore. We know where
exactly.
We know where to
exactly.
go. Perfect.
But you have to know the password, though.
We tried growing spring onions in this house, and we got like a puppy about 2 months ago, and the puppy got in and ate the spring onions, and apparently they're toxic to the puppy, so we did rush it to the vet. So that was the end of my growing. So I think I'll be over to yours for dinner, I think.
What? So what happened? Did they have to like pump the puppy's stomach or something?
I just had to follow it around, making note of its stools and how watery they were and how green they were.
Must have had terrible breath as well.
Absolutely awful. But I mean, like, there's that, like, the idea of growing food, a lot of people find quite relaxing. Like, it's kind of therapeutic.
No, it is. It's amazing that you put a seed in the ground and then like 3 weeks later something's growing out of it. It is a bit mind-blowing, actually. I mean my grandfather, when I was a kid, he like grew stuff like that, you know. He had a rhubarb patch and all stuff like that, and I used to help him when I was a real tiny kid. Mm. But you know, as soon as I got older, I thought it was the squarest thing ever. So but now that it's a matter of like life or death survival, you know, I'm all over it again.
Can you sort of justify where you are at life and on how much you can identify with Alan Titchmarsh?
Probably, yes. That's a good benchmark you've got there.
Isn't it? Like, so the domestic disco, just before we get into any of the rest of it, we've been enjoying it in this house, but my missus gets dressed up and actually gets her hula hoop out, like, and that's not a euphemism for the dirtier listeners out there. She gets her hula hoop on, sparkly dress, and just sits in the living room just hula hooping for hours, however long as you're doing it.
Well, that's good. That's our perfect demographic there. I mean, you know, I think it came out a little bit from, I was supposed to be getting ready to go on tour, and then that got cancelled. And then my girlfriend had been watching this guy who was doing like an Instagram live thing, DJing from his garage somewhere in New York. And the thing that impressed me was just that like people were making comments as he was playing records, you know. So it seemed like the first thing that was like live, where it felt like, you know, somebody was performing to an audience, and so I just nicked his idea.
It feels perfect, like in terms of like the music you're playing is designed to be played in a club, but when you take that music and you talk about it on the radio, it loses something because it's not in the right environment. And this is coming, like, you know, I'm a radio host, that's my job, but like, you know, playing a club record on the radio is never the same as playing a club record in a club. But having the comments on means that you've got the best of both worlds. You got that sort of instant reaction side, and you've got that sort of vibe side.
Yeah, and hopefully people can turn up their smart speaker or whatever they're listening to it on and jump around. And that was, yeah, I was kind of surprised because we tried it out, and then the tipping point for me came in the first program we did. My girlfriend's favorite song is Dance This Mess Around by the B-52s. I put that on and she started dancing, and then I thought, all right, well, I don't like to see a woman dance alone. So I got up and started dancing as well. And it felt like, it did actually feel like we were in a club for a minute, and it was a real release, you know, and that's what we all needed during those times, wasn't it? You needed a time when you just forgot about what was going on and just concentrated on actually dancing to the 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, and that's a merciful release sometimes.
It really is. Like there was a couple of times around the first month or two of lockdown that I think the first time I got on Zoom with my friends and we all got trashed, maybe like on a Friday evening, I woke up the next day with a splitting hangover, like, and I had convinced myself that I'd been out. Like in my head, I'd been out, I'd walked around pubs and I'd like had a big night out, and I couldn't remember how I got to bed, although I may have just like walked 10 meters. But also I've done one or two streams of like DJ sets, right? And they're so stressful. It keeps getting taken down and your stream keeps going. Like, did you find that as well?
Oh, God. Yeah, it was. I mean, because I've been mollycoddled for many years, you know, being in a band, you have like a road crew to plug everything in for you. Mm-hmm. So suddenly I was thrown back on having to plug everything in and try and make it work myself. So the first, I think after during the first one, I blew the power amp up at some point. So that was the end of that first one.
Yeah.
I think things kept getting unplugged. I think there was one point where I was kind of running around the living room just shouting slag at this piece of equipment that wouldn't work, you know. It was super stressful because it always seems to be like you can test it out and everything's okay. And as soon as you press broadcast live, everything just falls apart.
Yeah.
And anyway, eventually I did what I should have done in the first place, which was ring our sound man up and just get him to tell me what to do. Unfortunately, we'd already done three by that point.
Yeah, they kept building as well. I remember my sister was really excited because she was watching it before me and she shouted upstairs. She was like, "What? Well, they've come downstairs. They've added a disco ball."
We did, yeah. Well, I kept finding things. I had a laser down in my studio that doesn't work particularly well. There was one week when I was having to solder that like about 5 minutes before we were going on. And then I found this laser torch that we used to have. Then somebody lent us a smoke machine. That was when it really started to go high production values then. Mm. Yeah, it was nice to try and add a different thing each time. And so, to make it feel like it was a clubby atmosphere, you know.
With the Slacker podcast, we kind of jump about the place. I mean, there's no real rhyme or reason to podcasts anyway. I suppose a question before we get into it really is you've been a radio host, you've done shows in Australia, for our UK listeners, everybody knows the Sunday Service. Have you thought about getting into the podcast game? And if so, have you got an idea for it?
Well, I've kind of got into it slightly surreptitiously. There's a show that I do for Radio 4 called Wireless Nights, and they're all available as podcasts. You know, they're just like half an hour things where it's really me being a bit nosy as to what people get up to at night. So that varies. Like, we had a guy who just liked to go to his shed at night, supposedly to watch for a badger that came onto his allotment, but actually just to drink on his own without his wife knowing about it.
That always seems to be the way, isn't it?
Yeah. So we just like had audio of him getting progressively more drunk during the night. But then other things like somebody who went out trying to take pictures of foxes at night, people who work on the underground at night, you know, who tidy it all up. Just a night watchman. I was a night watchman for a night. That was quite good. I was looking after a tower block on Euston Road, like walking around, shining a torch into darkened rooms and, you know, all that kind of, making sure there were no intruders in the vicinity. Over time, you become able to do that.
Is the perfect balance then really in the middle of kind of trying to sort out the world's issues with humor and with sort of strange lyrics and strange takes?
Well, it's a pat or easy answer to say yes, but I do think it has to be somewhere in the middle. You know, like, yeah. I don't really like works of art that haven't got some, you know, to have a little bit of humor in there, I think is important because, yeah, I think humor is really fundamental to people. It's how you kind of deal with, sometimes with quite challenging situations. If you can make a joke out of it in some way, you kind of neutralize it. So I think it's quite important. It seems to humanize things. But then again, I don't like joke songs. You know, I was never a fan of, you know, things like lip up fatty or lip up fat. You know, I can't bear things like that or whatever.
What do you call the guy from up your way with that used to wear this, like the papier mâché head? He used to do all the comedy songs.
Oh, Frank Sidebottom.
Frank Sidebottom, that's it. I always quite like, he always did comedy songs and I quite enjoyed them, but I enjoyed them in the same way I enjoyed like lo-fi recordings and stuff. It was just more of a sort of peering through the window, enjoying it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I never got to meet that guy. Apparently he was quite a strange person, and I think he did take it very seriously.
Yeah.
Well, you find that with comedians, you know.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, I've met a lot of comedians and like when on my radio show, I've had a lot come true and stuff. And they're as much crack as, what is it my friend used to say? They're as much crack as blood in your piss. some of the ones have come true. But what song has made you laugh out loud and you remember as being like a real funny song? Like the one that comes to my mind right now. Now, you've written a few of them as well, but like Vicar in a Tutu by The Smiths always makes me laugh.
What, just because of the title?
Well, it's not like the just the title. It's the line, isn't it? Oh no, sorry. Frankly, Mr. Shankly, sorry. It's the line. I never knew you wrote poetry. I never knew you wrote such bloody awful poetry. I just remember hearing that for the first time and pissing myself laughing, going, "That's just a banging line," do you know?
Yeah. You've got me now. I'm trying to think of a line that has made me laugh.
Well, maybe
I don't know whether it's particularly would make me laugh, but I do like it when a line in a song takes you by surprise. I remember being in a club, you know, years ago and listening to that Born Slippy song and thinking, oh, it really sounds like they're shouting lager, lager, lager. And then I just suddenly realized they are actually shouting lager, lager, lager. And just thinking, you can't sing lager in a song. That's just not proper lyrics, you know. So I like it when somebody does something like that, which you just really wouldn't have seen coming, you know.
Well, like they were the weird one, because like obviously growing up in Northern Ireland is very much like growing up in the north of England. Like we're all educated by our bigger brothers' record collections, and that they tended to be around my age, like, you know, the Stone, like bigger brothers listening to the Stone Roses and Underworld and stuff like that. I never knew that Underworld actually had another song other than Born Slippy. And then when I got older and listened to them, I was like, actually, they're pretty intelligent and quite good musicians.
Yeah, yeah, there's much more to them than lager.
Or Mega Mega White Thing. what was the first record that you ever bought with your own earned money?
Right, well, the first LP that I bought was David Bowie Changes One Bowie, that it's like a greatest hits compilation. It's got like a black and white picture of him on the front. I actually wanted to buy the Stranglers first LP, but I was scared that my mum would tell me off because it was like a punk record. So I thought David Bowie was a safer bet.
What era of Bowie was that?
Well, it was, I guess it must have been around, if I was considering buying the Stranglers, then it must have been like 1977. So I would have been like 13, 14 years old. And it was a compilation. So it went, I think the first track on it is Changes, and it goes through the 70s stuff. And the latest thing on it is like Golden Years and stuff like that.
Were you bothered with punk rock when it came out? Like, I mean, suppose 13 is pretty good age to be taken away with it, right?
It was, I'll always be grateful for it, really, because I'd wanted to be in a band since I was like, I don't know, seven or something like that. I used to watch the Beatles films when they always used to show Beatles movies on Boxing Day at 10:30 in the morning. So I used to make sure I was up and watch those, and I was kind of obsessed with the Beatles. And I knew that I wanted to be in a band, but I had no real idea of how to do it. Like I say, it wasn't on the school curriculum at all. And there seemed to be no clues. And when I looked at, like, so I once had a look at the Beatles songbook, you know, and it made me feel so depressed, because it seemed like every song had about 25 chords in it. And so there's just no way I'm ever going to be able to do that. So then punk music came along, and you know, there's that famous thing like, here's one chord, here's another, now go and form a band. And suddenly musical ability didn't matter. In fact, it was kind of almost a disability if you could play properly. It was more about the attitude of it or something. So it was absolutely perfect for me. Suddenly the fact that I couldn't actually play wasn't an issue. So that was it. I just formed a band and we stumbled around doing it.
What was the first band called?
It was called Pulp right from the beginning.
Oh,
it
right. So, just, like, you've been in Pulp. Oh, well, I mean, like, you know, obviously Pulp's not going anymore, but, like, that was the very first band. There was no iterations or anything beforehand.
Yeah, it was actually called Arabicus Pulp at the start, because I think we were in an economics lesson and they'd given us a copy of the Financial Times to look at. And, you know, they've got like commodities in the back, and and we were just looking, and there's something called Arabicus pulp, which I think is something to do with coffee, you know.
Yeah, it makes it sound like you go to Eton, like these are all like on your break reading the Financial Times with like a nice little like cigar or whatever.
No, it really didn't happen that much at school. It was just like they showed it you in the economics lesson. I still don't understand it at all.
How long objectively were you rubbish for before you actually became a good band? Because no band's a good band from the start.
No, we weren't. We were bad. As I say, we didn't really have an idea of what we were doing. So we would just make a noise. And then eventually you get bored of making noise because you start like getting a headache. So then you try and make it into a song. But yeah, the first concert that we ever played, that was in 1980. We were on like a local bands festival bill. And I think we were popular from the start, actually, but really because of our ineptitude, because it was the first time we'd been on a proper stage. So up to that point, we'd been playing through the hi-fi at home, and suddenly we were playing through amplifiers. Like, for instance, the bass player, his bass started feeding back, and he just didn't know what to do, so he just walked away from the speaker, but unfortunately he didn't look where he was going and he fell off stage. So
yeah,
all this, I think people would just be amused thinking, who are these idiots? Like, I was the oldest. I was 16 at that point, and the drummer was like 14. And they just thought, I suppose they found us charming in a way. And so then we just got invited to go and play concerts in pubs and stuff, which was great because we were still underage and we weren't allowed in pubs. So it was kind of like we were liked for being rubbish from the start. and in some ways, when we started to learn, when we learned to play a bit better, people kind of lost interest. Which is right back, you know, this is because the comedy aspect had disappeared.
Yeah, you said lost a little of your like allure, some of the magic had ran off. I really like, I mean, I played in bands for my whole, like, God, from about 14 till about 24. And I love the romance. Like, thinking back now, I mean, at the time I fucking hated it, but at the time, like, now thinking back, the idea of everybody's amps busting, people swapping amps, like fights over who's using what cymbals, nobody showing up, loads of people showing up. Like, those local band nights, I think, are some of like really what I think bands are in essence. Like, a band to me almost isn't somebody that's playing on the Royal Albert Hall or playing O2 Academy. A band to me is almost standing up on that stage, like looking around for a buzzing cable.
Yeah, it's all that stuff. I mean, the first time you play a concert, it's mind-blowing how much can go wrong. Like you mentioned, leads there. All you've got to do is step on the cable and it comes out. Like you, for me as a singer, it's the microphone cable that's always doing me. You know, you see, if you happen to stand on the microphone cable and then you pull the microphone up to start singing, it will just unplug itself. So then you kind of really kind of over emoting into this thing that's not plugged in, and it looks really bad. But like you say, that kind of stuff, I'm really glad that we went through all that stuff, because I think you're right in that it is kind of the essence of being in a band, because through that process of trial and error, you learn how to deal with that, and you learn what's important about being on stage. It's not always about playing everything perfectly and everything, the sound being pristine and all stuff like that. It's, you're just trying to make a connection with the people in the audience, you know. And I think, you know, things going wrong is part of life. it's humanity.
Speaking of which, have you ever had like a bad injury, like performing live? Like, I mean, I've seen you leap around the stage. Like, there's no way that you couldn't have at least twisted an ankle in the time that you've been playing.
Well, touch wood, I've never had a massively bad injury. The one I can remember is we played in Japan once, and it was a strange stage. It was like made up of different panels. And at some point I'd been jumping around and then I was on the floor, and then my finger got caught in between where two of these panels joined up, and it really pinched it really hard. And then it was really painful. I couldn't really play the guitar anymore. So the next day we went to like an acupuncturist, and he got this thing. It was really weird. It was like, it looked like a cigarette end, and he put it on the end of the finger that was affected. Sorry, I'm going to have to cough here. He put it on the end of the finger that was affected, and he set fire to it, and he said something, and the translator said, when your finger gets really hot and painful, tell him and he'll take it off. So I just sat there for about 10 minutes, and the finger was getting hotter and hotter and hotter, and then eventually went, can it come off now, please? And I was really thinking, this is absolute, you know, quackery or whatever.
Yeah.
But amazingly, it worked, and I was fine, and I could play the guitar again because we had another concert that night, and I was fine.
Wow.
There you go.
I'm surprised you didn't bottle this guy and just like take him around with you everywhere. He sounds like the healer that you need.
Yeah, it was good. He also did that thing. Have you seen that thing sometimes? Did they call it cupping?
Oh, isn't that where they like suction cup your back with? Is it with stones or is it with like air? I don't know.
They're like, you know, if you get like a posh yogurt and it comes in like a glass thing rather than a plastic thing.
What's that, a ramekin? Like little,
yeah, exactly, yeah. Ramekins. Yeah. So they're like that, like a glass ramekin. But I went down for this therapy with our then tour manager, who was a bit overweight, and he decided to have this cupping thing, which is supposed to be relaxing. And so they did it on his back, and there were all these ramekins like full of flesh that had like sucked up from his back. And he looked like a stegosaurus, you know, like those dinosaurs. And it's always stuck in my mind. It took my mind off my poorly finger anyway.
It might be like, I've got an image, like it's like a facelift except for your body. So he probably looks really thin, where it's all like, it's all pulled back into like some sort of girdle, some human girdle. So like one of the things I wanted to ask you about when like there was probably the first question on the sheet when I was prepping this was like the relationship you had with one of my idols and one of my sort of somebody that I looked up to a lot anyways, John Peel. He's always had a massively soft spot for your music and was probably one of the earliest champions of pulp, wasn't he?
Well, it's a funny story with him actually, because he was. I mean, I wouldn't have had a musical career without him. And I think I can say that categorically, really, because what happened was the very first demo that Pulp recorded, say, like, you know, maybe a year after that song that I played you earlier, we went to record a demo. This guy had a studio set up in his house. It was like a semi-detached house, and you had to record in his bedroom, which was a bit strange, but anyway, we did a demo, and then John Peel used to do these roadshow things where he would go around university and polytechnic sites and play in the uni bar and stuff like that. And so I saw he was doing one at Sheffield Polytechnic. So I ran off a cassette of this demo that we'd done, and I hand drew a sleeve for it and all that kind of thing. Went to this roadshow that he was doing, waited till he'd finished, and then I followed him out into the car park and didn't mug him, but just said, sorry, Mr. Peel, but you know, it is a demo tape of my band. Would you, you know, I'd like to give it to you. Would you have a listen to it? And he said, oh yeah, I'll have a listen to it on the way back home. And then weirdly enough, he actually did that. And we got a phone call maybe 3 days later asking us to go down and do a John Peel session. Wow. Down in London, which was just like, mind-blowing, because I'd been listening to that's how I discovered punk music and stuff like that. He was the only person playing it back in those days. So I listened to that show every single night. So it was like going to heaven being asked to do that.
I mean, that's incredible. Anybody who's listened to this outside of the UK and doesn't know who John Peel is like the, probably the biggest legend in alternative music anywhere, I would say. He did a show on Radio 1. And back in those days, like playing alternative music or playing unsigned music or taking a chance on sonically different music wasn't the usual. Like Radio 1, I mean, I work for Radio 1. I do a show on Radio 1 now, but... Radio 1 back then was full of people wearing jumpers and probably playing the least exciting music possible. They all talk like this. They all hear the top. As the numbers get smaller, the hits get bigger. That sort of shit, wasn't it?
Yeah, you're right.
But when you played that Peel session, did it feel like, right, this is the catalyst to stardom now?
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It did, because we were still at school. So I think by now I was 17. And we went down and did that. And I was just convinced. That's what convinced me to be in a band as a career. So when we got to the end of school, I just said to my mum, I'm not going to college. You know, I'm going to be a pop star. And unfortunately, all the rest of the band, their parents just laughed at them when they said that, and they all had to go off to university. And so I ended up in Sheffield all alone with my dream. And then the tough years began, because then John Peel never played anything by Paul until about nearly 20, well, about 15 years later. So it was weird. He encouraged me, and then I stayed in Sheffield and carried on with different lineups of a band, with getting more and more unsuccessful until I finally left Sheffield at the end of the 80s.
How many versions of Pulp is there? Because obviously you say, like, when your friends go to college when you're 18 or 19, you have to get a new band in, don't you? Like, so there must be a really technical graph out there of Pulp past and present members.
Yeah, you know what? I don't know exactly how many, but there must be a lot. I mean, bass players, we used to go through, you know, like in Spinal Tap, it's always the drummers that disappear, but in Pulp, it was always the bass players would disappear.
You're not quite as bad as Mark E. Smith and the Fall.
No, but that would be difficult to be as bad as him. he seemed to sack somebody every week. I didn't really sack people, but we just had strange people. Like, we once had this keyboard player called Captain Sleep. I can't even remember what his real name was, but we called him Captain Sleep because he just was asleep. Or when occasionally he would be awake on stage, but like whenever you were in the van traveling anywhere, he was just always asleep. I think he was just like terminally depressed, and he was trying to not be alive in the world.
Maybe he was like a narcoleptic or something. He just kept
poking. Oh yeah, maybe I'm being really unkind, and he actually had a clinical problem. I don't know.
Did you have like crazy industry people working for you as well, like management? Because the short time that I was in my band, we had a sort of crusty styled hippie manager who was. Had to get the sack pretty sharpish. We had another manager who kind of ripped us off a bit. Like, I mean, you kind of meet a lot of weird people on the industry side too.
Well, our first manager, that was just a kid at school who was even worse musically than us. So he said, well, I can't be in the band, so I'll just be the manager. But, you know, we weren't even playing concerts. So all it was just so he could hang around with us. And come to rehearsals and just sit there drinking whilst we played. And then after that, yeah, we did eventually get a manager. But I was lucky that, I mean, I never had a really terrible manager. There was once one manager who, he tried to encourage me to write a song like Wham. Wham were quite new at that time. I think Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go had just become a big hit. And he thought that I could write pop songs like that. And there's an early Pulp single called Everybody's Problem, which is, I wouldn't recommend anybody to listen to it. But the thing about it is that was our attempt to write a song. I kind of went along with it because he was a bit older. So I thought, oh, well, he's a grown up, so maybe I should take notice of him. We wrote this song that I really wasn't that into. It was quite catchy. And then we were in the studio recording it, and it came the time for me to sing the vocal, and it was one of the most disturbing times of my life, because halfway through singing it, I just suddenly realized that it was the shittiest song ever. And so I got to the end of the take, and then he said, yeah, okay, a couple more takes. And I said, I honestly just cannot sing that song anymore. It's a real mistake. And I didn't. I don't know. I just dug my heels in and said, I'm not singing that song anymore. So eventually it got released. It's just got this really lackluster. You could just hear somebody losing interest in the song as it goes on. And I even kind of messed the words up at some point, and I just wouldn't go in and redo it. So it's a strange thing.
What was the track that turned the tide then? Was there a track or a moment or performance or album that like kind of brought you out of the unsigned obscurity, kind of where you were lingering for a bit?
Yeah, I think what happened was, so we'd been around for a while. I left Sheffield because I could just feel that it was going nowhere. And people, the final straw was the bass player, yet again, when the bass player went and joined this kind of evangelical church that was right opposite where I was living at the time. And I just thought, oh, if I stay here, I'm going to end up in that church.
You could have been a preacher. Yeah.
Stuff. So I just, I've got to get out of here. I've got to escape. So I was lucky enough to be able to get a place at art college and went down, and the band kind of went into suspended animation then. We never really officially split up, but I was at college and stuff, but we were kind of trying to work on a record. We still had a record deal with a small indie label. I'd been to a rave when I first got to London. It was like 1988, so it was when Acid House was first coming out. And I kind of went to a rave, and that blew my mind.
Literally.
It was just such an amazing thing. You know, I didn't know that nightlife could be like that. So then we went back to this record that we were doing, and I said, we've got to embrace rave. So what that really boiled down to was that our poor drummer, Nick, had to like learn how to program a drum machine and replace all his drums with this drum machine, because we thought that made it sound modern and ravey.
Yeah.
But I'm getting round to the point now of the question that you actually asked, which was there a song that changed the tide? And there was a song on that record called My Legendary Girlfriend, and that came out as a single just towards the end of me finishing college. And it got reviewed. I think it got like Single of the Week in the NME, and that was like everything at that time. And so that was the beginning of the tide turning and of things starting to happen. People actually seemed to want to listen to us, which was weird, you know, because I'd kind of given up on the band really at that point.
It's crazy like how you traversed like two of the most important cultural movements in recent times in the UK, because like obviously Acid House in the late 80s, early 90s was really important, and then you were kind of like the poster band for Britpop. And what I found interesting, because like I was technically alive during the both, but I mean I was probably chewing on rusks, so I don't really remember much about it, but they were completely opposite in terms of spirit and mood. Like Acid House was all about love and like, you know, getting into a rave and not trying to pull, like, you know what I mean, just trying to dance. And then Britpop was this like heady narcissism. Like did you see that there being a tide shift for that to happen?
I don't think that I mean, I don't like to say that word, the B word, but I don't think that it started off that way. I think, you know, it was indie music, really. You know, there'd been indie music. I suppose the Smiths, we've talked about before, were like the standard bearers for that. And there was the indie chart in the NME. And like, if you got Single of the Week in NME, that was a big thing. But that scene was a small scene. And then suddenly around the early 90s, that scene started to get more mainstream attention. And at the start, that was very exciting because, you know, there was a lot of weirdos in indie bands. And so it wasn't so kind of private jet, you know, it wasn't. It was still Transit Van at that point. Mm. And it seemed kind of exciting because you thought, well, maybe all these marginal chances. Yeah, because we used to go to, there was this club called Smashing, which was like it was a really good club. It was in a basement on Regent Street. It was a club that had been shut for ages. Apparently, it used to be called Eve's in the 60s, and it had been where the Profumo affair happened, like where Lord Profumo first met Christine Keeler and all that kind of thing. It had plastic fruit kind of stapled to the walls and this little light-up dance floor. Yeah. It was a brilliant place. And it was a really good club. It was like a real mixed crowd of, you know, just anybody could go there as long as they were kind of interesting. What we used to do, if we had to make a video, we would just look at the dance floor at Smashing and say, oh, well, yeah, it was just a shame. You know, it just, I don't know, it just got corrupted. And the fact that cocaine became the main drug on the scene didn't help, because that isn't very good for character development, that particular substance.
But you need, like, it's a really, really expensive, like, drug, and it, like, almost like they say that certain drugs, like, you know, are the same as the times, like, so like you had ecstasy and acid rave, you had cocaine in Britpop. Would you agree to that?
Yeah, it's a pity. If it had been a more consciousness expanding thing rather than consciousness narrowing thing, it could have been a whole different thing.
What's the most ridiculous thing that you've heard somebody say when they were off their head?
These lampshades are exquisite.
Maybe they were.
They were all right, but when you find yourself talking about lampshades, you know that something's gone wrong.
I was thinking about this. I was thinking about this actually not too long ago, about the alternative bands that I like that end up going, that have success in the mainstream, tend to have music that will the album will work for the adult, but there'll be a single that'll work for the kid. So like, the whole family can listen to it and take different things out of it. It's like watching Father Ted or Only Fools and Horses or something. the kid's watching it and enjoying it for a completely different reason that the adult is, because the adult gets it. And that's kind of how I felt, because I was actually a legitimate massive Pulp fan when I was seven. when I was like seven, Different Class came out, and I was listening to Common People and Disco 2000 and not understanding anything about what they were about. It was just catchy and I enjoyed singing it.
Yeah, but that's what pop music, when it works properly, it should be, you know. It's... And that's why I like dance music as well, because dance music's working on those levels. The bottom line is, can you dance to it? But then musically, it can say anything, and then the lyrics can put another thing on top of that. And you can, like you say, you can just choose which bit you tune into.
Yeah, I remember.
And that's good.
I remember our house, there was wood chip on the wall, and I heard that on the track, and I was like, we've got that!
Yeah, that's a very popular line. Yeah, when Pulp reformed and we did some shows in 2011, I was wanting to sell wood chip wallpaper on the merch store. I thought this would be the best merch ever, but I got outvoted.
Oh, I think that's a big shame. I was going through the side project. Part of your Wikipedia, and it's the deepest side project headline or paragraph or prose or whatever it is that I've seen on anybody's. It's and yet I saw you say in an interview that you didn't think that your output was good enough. I mean, from reading through it, it seems like it's perfectly more than adequate.
All right, well, that's very nice of you to say. I just find, I don't know, when I look at how many records I've released. Like I think Paul Weller's got a record out this Friday, hasn't he? And I'm sure it said something like it's his 37th album or something like that. And I just thought, well, I'm never going to catch up with him. I think I've been involved in maybe 10 records or something. So I guess that's what I think. I mean, I've been lucky to work with other people and do other stuff, you know, occasional songs and things. But... yeah, I mean, I think if songwriting is your business, you're always going to want to have done more of it. Because for me, songwriting, although I know it is my livelihood, it's also the way that I kind of find out things about myself and also about the world as well. So, I don't have a diary. It's like the nearest I've got to a diary as well. So, I just wish that I'd done more of it, really.
Isn't it like the sort of balance of quality and quantity? Like, I'm not saying Paul Weller hasn't got quality in those, like all those albums that he does. I mean, Bob Dylan released an album last week or 2 weeks ago, and I listened to it, and it's really good, and it's from somebody.
Well, I'm jealous, yeah, because I want to get that. But, yeah. You know, there's no record shops open around here, but I really want to get, because I heard the... Murder Most Foul song, and I thought that was brilliant.
It's really good. You don't mess with the streaming platforms, your Spotify's or your Apple Music's?
Well I could do, but I suppose I just like to have a record. I don't know, I like that thing of putting it on the turntable, and I like the fact that, you know, it'll be split over two sides or four sides or whatever, and that's almost like chapters of a book or something. For me, it seems like that's, you're not really listening to a record unless you listen to it that way. I think that's why vinyl's kind of had that resurgence lately, is that I think that's its format. You know, things have got a format that work, and I think that's the best format for listening to recorded music. In my humble opinion,
I know like people my age like have started buying vinyl again, but I kind of question whether they're buying the vinyl as a fashion statement or as something that looks good in their flat, or they're actually buying it to play it.
Well, yeah, it could be that, but as I say, I never really fell out with it. I mean, I think the CD was just the worst idea ever, you know. They're just those horrible plastic cases that you only have to like drop it on the floor once, and then there's a big massive crack down the middle
totally
of it.
Screwed, yeah.
And then you try and stack them up on top of each other, but they're a bit too slippy, so then they fall over. And it's just, they're just horrible. And then also, you put it on. Are you going to sit there for an hour and 10 minutes listening to the same album? Not really. Bit boring. And then all you've got to do is have like touched it slightly with your finger. And then when you try and play it, it's going, it starts doing that thing. So just rubbish. Plus that led to people being able to rip things and therefore post them on the internet and therefore kill the whole music industry. So CDs were just the worst thing ever. And I'm glad that I will not mourn their passing.
No.
And I'm glad that I stuck with records in the interim.
I agree. Like I when I moved to London in 2012, I threw out my whole CD collection, apart from any of the ones that were in mint condition. I gave them to charity shops, but like all the rest of them, I just hemorrhaged them into a skip, and I didn't pass it to one tier. I don't have a CD at all now. And young bands, and this still blows my mind in 2020, because I do have a show where I get to pick my own music, and young bands will still hand me a CD, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, like what year is it? Like what's going on? Like surely by this stage you should be able to just like plug a USB into the back of my head and I can hear it.
I know, but then USBs, unless it's hard to know, at least a CD, I suppose you can write in felt tip the name of the band on it, and then when you're going through your carrier bag later on, you go, oh yeah, that bloke gave me that. But if you suddenly kind of get a USB stick out, you just think, oh, did a spy give me that? You know, has that got some state secrets on it or something? You don't really know what it doesn't. At least a CD, you've got that kind of vestigial kind of idea that it's round, so it kind of looks like a disc, so there's probably music on it. Whereas a USB could just have anything on it.
I have thought about that. Like there was a fella who handed me a USB in a club in Dublin, and he just looked really odd and a little bit off kilter, and just I don't know. Like he just like had that sort of like conspiracy theory vibe about him. And when I went to go to plug it in to listen to it, because part of me was like sitting there going, I need to hear what this is, because this could be amazing, or I don't know, but I need to hear it. And then the other part of me was like going, God, he could be infecting my computer with viruses. I don't know what to do.
Be malware.
I don't think it was, although my laptop didn't last too long after that, so who knows. What I was going to say, like the Harry Potter thing that you were in, right? Like, and I'm not going to talk too much about that, but I did like sort of have this daydream of what that actual band would sound like in real life, with because the fictional band in Harry Potter was you and members of Radiohead, members of Pulp, members of Relaxed Muscle. And then I was like getting to think going, God, that band would be really good. I'd love to see that band in real life.
Yeah, it was, we were quite good. And we had a few rehearsals. It was a strange thing that, because we were supposed to be called the Weird Sisters, because that's the name of the band in J.K. Rowling's book. But then something weird happened. I think there was a lesbian folk duo from Canada who had the same name, and they threatened to sue if they used the name Weird Sisters. So then we became known as the Band with No Name, which was the lamest thing ever. And I don't know. It's a long time ago that we had good fun recording the music, for sure. And the best fun of all was when we actually went to the film set and did it, because they had all these extras there. We were actually on set for 3 days. And for that whole 3 days, we had like 300 people screaming at us like we were the Beatles for 3 days. It was just like amazing.
It's hard to beat. Mm. Sex music. How do you miss it? Like, did you enjoy like making that? Obviously, you must have, because you did it for 7-ish years. But like, it was an appointment to listen every Sunday, that show.
Well, thank you. Well, like you were saying about your show, it's amazing when you are just allowed to pick whatever music you want to play. And more than that, I also managed, you know, I was allowed to like read stories, and sometimes I would interview people. Like, I got to interview David Attenborough once, you know, which was brilliant. So, yeah, I loved doing that show. It was it was, and especially also with it being on a Sunday afternoon, because, you know, what happens on a Sunday afternoon? I like the fact that it's that kind of weird kind of dead zone in the week where nothing can really happen. So maybe people would be prepared to just like lie down on the settee and listen to me ramble on for an hour or so, you know. And the whole idea was to try and create some kind of mellow atmosphere so that if you'd been up too late the night before, you could just kind of settle into this nice fluffy cloud with little poems and soft songs and things like that. And it was great. I got to create that environment and loved it, yeah. But it kind of, I guess it ran its course eventually. Well, I kind of gave it up in the end because I wanted to, I kind of felt that if I didn't really apply myself to getting another record ready, then maybe I would never ever make another record in my life and I would be kind of done in by that.
Yeah, well... It would have been counterproductive for Six Music, wouldn't it? Like, it's great having you on the station, but it might be even better to like actually have some music of yours to play on it.
Yeah. I've still got ties. Like during the lockdown, I did do this thing, these really short, like 10-minute things, which were called Jarvis in the House, and basically all that was during the lockdown. I thought, well, people are probably getting a bit claustrophobic, so I'll try and make them see their house in a slightly more exciting manner. So each week I would go into a different room. Like I think we started in the kitchen and we had an adventure in the kitchen. And then we went and had an adventure in the bathroom and stuff like that. And that was just like a little feature that was in the afternoon show.
I mean, like you've definitely sounded like you've like approached the pandemic and the lockdown with the right attitude, getting the positivity out of it instead of just being sort of bowed down by it. Have you found that like it's hampered the release or made it better of your Jarvis like release that's coming out in September? Has it?
Well, it's coming out in July now.
It's
coming out in just over 2 weeks' time, which I'm quite excited about. Normally people don't release records in the summer, but I guess the thinking is that most people will still be at home because they probably can't afford to go on holiday, you know. So we're going to release it then. Well, it hampered it in such a way as we had to cancel our tour, which was a massive pain. And then we haven't been able to play together as a band. Like, you know, we've had a few Zoom conversations. And the very first Zoom that we had, we thought, oh, well, this is it. We could play together now. We're all on the same computer screen.
How did that work?
And then as soon as you start trying to make some noise, you realize that there's all these different time lags going on. So you just sound like, it basically sounded like our very first rehearsals when I was 14, when you just don't know what you're doing. And now I've got very accomplished musicians in the band now. So I knew there was something wrong. So that's been a drag. We've tried to counteract that by doing a bit of a like musical consequences game where one member of the band will record a musical idea and then send it to another member and they add a bit and then they pass it on to the next member. We've kind of done a couple of songs that way and that's kept us going a bit.
That sounds quite fun. Has anything sort of good come out of it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether we'll release them eventually, but it just kept us going and communicating with each other in a kind of pleasurable way. And I hope that they might turn into proper songs, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what's the story with the record? Because obviously this is you getting a band back together for the first time in quite some time.
Yeah, that's true. And that was the key to it, really. All through that time when I'd been doing the radio show and stuff, I'd still been coming up with ideas for songs, but never quite finishing them. And then I kind of forced my own hand, basically. I was invited to go and play a festival in Iceland. That group Sigur Rós, they were having their own festival in Reykjavik. And they invited me, and I was on the verge of turning it down because I didn't have a band. And then I just, on the spur of the moment, I just said, yeah, I'll do it. And then suddenly panicked and realized, okay, I've said I'm going to do it. I better get a band then. And I was lucky, you know, Serafina and Emma, the women in the band, I'd produced a record for Serafina, so I knew that I really liked her musicianship and songwriting. So she said she'd be in it. And we just got it together quickly. And as soon as that happened, it was like, as you know, the very first time that we actually had a rehearsal, these songs that I'd been kind of sweating over and wondering about for ages suddenly came alive. And I thought, well, why didn't I think of that like 6 years ago? You know, it's a bit crazy. I've been in a band most of my adult life. Why didn't I just realize that was the way to go forward? But
yeah, but sometimes you got to miss it to realize what you're missing, right?
No, I think that there is something in that. There is something in that, that you can get a bit blasé or a little bit blind to stuff. And
or just fucked off with the people in the band. Sometimes you need to freshen it up and go and try stuff with other people.
Yeah, and then as soon as you do that, and then the next stage of that was then we went and played those songs before we'd recorded them, before they were really totally finished, really, to audiences. We played small shows, and some of the record, actually the basic tracks, got recorded at some of those shows. So again, in a weird way, we accidentally did something that, you know, it's not possible for a band to record that way now because nobody can play shows, you know. So we actually made use of that live experience. So I'm really glad that we kind of did that. Well, glad and not glad, because obviously I'm not glad that we're in the middle of a pandemic, which means that we can't play concerts anymore. But at least we took advantage of it whilst it was there.
Is House Music All Night Long going to be on the album?
It is. It's the first track on side two.
Boom. How do you like this? I've just like typed in because I was listening to your music earlier, I got sent the album about like literally about an hour before this, so I've been listening to bits and pieces of it. But on your Spotify, your fans also like is Jarvis Cocker is the number one. Where do they get this stuff from?
What's on Spotify?
So when you type in Jarvis, right, and you've got House Music All Night Long open,
yeah,
there's a column, it says fans also like Jarvis Cocker, Tim Burgess, yeah, Jenny Beth, BC Camplight, Nadine Shah, Baxter Jury, and the Orioles.
Yeah, I know. Well, we had trouble with that. Obviously, the band is called My Name in a slightly changed version, but It's all down to those algorithms that we're always being told about. You know, as a person, you can definitely tell that Jarvis and Jarvis are the same thing, but a computer won't know that. The punctuation throws it off the scent. It just shows when people talk about, you know, AI is taking over, it's not that clever.
I'm going to tell that to Elon Musk.
Yeah, do.
Listen, I've taken up loads of your time. Thank you for coming on the Slacker podcast. Good luck with the record, and thanks for helping us all smile through a pretty shitty year.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.